Oh, Madeline, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Perfect. Well, Madeline, this is Rebecca Marina, and this is Melon Thomas Benedict, everyone. I'm so proud to have him as a guest on my call today, and so pleased to bring you a person of such integrity. I was telling the callers early, Melon, that when I discovered your website, your information, your picture, everything just resonated with me so deeply and with my 15-year-old daughter as well. And it just touched me in a very great way, and I know we've talked several times, and I just enjoy so much listening to everything you have to say. So welcome, Melon Thomas Benedict, to this call.
Well, it's good to be online with you.
Great. So I think we'll just get started by you start off telling us what happened to you, and I'll just throw in questions that come up and just take it away. And how did it happen and everything about it? We want to know.
Well, thanks. My story began about 1981, when I was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer and was given 6 to 8 months to live. And, you think this always happens to someone else and other people, and then one day you're sitting in the doctor's office and he's looking at you, telling you your life is going to wind down very shortly. And this was something I was completely unprepared for, because up until this time, I had never heard of the word hospice or, metaphysics or anything like that. I was pretty much thick as a brick, and was a stained glass artist for many years of my life, and quite happy just pursuing my art. But I started having a series of headaches and then a minor blackout. I did end up in being referred from one doctor to the next. I end up with a neurologist who then did the final diagnosis. And I was sort of a wisecracker, and I'll never forget when the doctor came in, to show me the test, I wisecracked and said, "Hey, Doc, am I going to live?" And he didn't have to say anything. It was a look on his face.
Oh, my goodness.
It was he wasn't laughing. And then he proceeded to tell me that the condition I had was a form of brain cancer that at the time was inoperable and incurable. And then, and I don't know if anyone listening has been through this sort of terminal diagnosis, but I didn't even hear much of what he was saying. All I heard was, you have 6 to 8 months to live.
Wow.
Nothing we can do about it. And before the meeting was over, he suggested that they get me on aggressive chemo and possibly radiation right away. And I said, "What good will that do?" And he said, "Well, we could slow it down." And of course, if you're diagnosed terminal, you do want to take every possible chance you can to live. But something happened that was very interesting. He sent in a colleague of his, a specialist, the chemo doctor. And he sat down with me and started explaining that, of course, it was optional if I wanted, because it was an incurable condition, it was certainly optional. And I thought, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It was optional. But he was very honest with me. I said, "How much time will this give me?" And he said, "Actually, we don't know. We can't say with your condition. And probably this kind of aggressive treatment, you will probably end up a vegetable before you die."
Oh, my goodness.
And I thought, that doesn't sound very good. And so the doctor suggested, he said, "I would suggest that you just go home and make peace with your life and contact people to help you with this." And at the time, I was hadn't spoken to my family, my mother, father, or brother, in about 6 years from family squabbles.
Wow.
I believe I had only the average of dysfunctional American family, but
yes.
we all take these things seriously. So my thought was, I can't go home and die. But on the other hand, what am I going to do? So I was very lucky to have found, through a friend of mine, a woman who led me into hospice care. And I'd never heard of hospice before I ended up in hospice care.
It's a wonderful program.
Yes, it really is. And I volunteered with groups around the country since my experience. But I ended up in a hospice care situation, and I had a I prepared a living will because, one thing I discovered in my near-death experience is why I had gotten ill, and that's I think a major life lesson for people. I'm someone who literally, born in 1949, I lived through the 50s and the 60s and the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis and all that sort of thing. And I really believed what all the experts were telling us back then, and this is back like in the 60s, that, the overpopulation, the nuclear threat, all the things we're hearing today. The ecology couldn't stand what humanity was doing to it. And in fact, the experts were saying at the time that even if we stopped all human activity at that time, there was still no hope for the world. We couldn't turn it around in time. And there was lots of that stuff going on in those days. And what's amazing is that those times now seem to be repeating now. All of those issues seem to be repeating right now. Again, 25 years later for me, because I had my near-death experience in 1982. But, I really thought for much of my life that really there was a good possibility that the world was going to end in my lifetime. I mean, and I know there's probably thousands, if not millions, of other people that may be wondering about that.
I was taught that from a religious perspective, because of the evilness of the world, that Jesus was going to come back and take away all the good people, and only the people who stole that last cookie in the cookie jar were going to be left. And it was real scary for me.
And those times are back again. Back then, when I really got deep into this, there was people like Hal Lindsey, Late Great Planet Earth, and all of that negative stuff, doomsayers going on. At the same time, and we see that again today. Look at what's on TV. All this end of the world stuff is here again. But I literally, really started believing this stuff. And some people say it's a straw that broke the camel's back. Well, what really did me in was actually seeing a photograph put out by a well-intended ecology group back in the early 70s that actually compared an aerial photograph of the city of Los Angeles to a microscopic picture of a human cancer cell.
Really?
And they look the same. They were comparing the way humans had built the city of Los Angeles from the air, and it looked like an organism, but it looked crazy. Then they compared it to a cancer cell, and the cancer cell looked crazy, and they were very similar. And for some reason, from that moment on, it clicked in my head that nature had gone wrong and created a malignant cancer called humanity. And I began believing that. And to preface this is, I had no real spiritual background at this time. I wasn't even an atheist. At least they show some interest in the subject.
Yeah.
So this wasn't a religious or spiritual issue for me. It was basically, I really believed that nature had gone wrong. And humans were really going to, at some point, if not in my lifetime, shortly thereafter, ruin the whole planet. And wouldn't you know it, and this is a life lesson, wouldn't you know it that I began thinking of humans as a cancer on the planet, and years later, I ended up with brain cancer.
Wow.
I think there's a connection there with your worldview, the way you view the world.
Yeah.
And The odd thing is, too, that it ends up that my grandmother died of the same condition before me, and my mother died of the same brain condition after me.
Really?
It ran in the family. And also a sort of mindset kind of ran in my family. My grandmother, my mother were always thinking about everything that was wrong with the world. They were good people, but endlessly thinking of 10 negative scenarios for every positive one. So I was programmed to be a fairly negative person and look at the world in that way. But I survived by the grace of God or whatever you want to call it, whereas my grandmother and my mother didn't. So that's kind of interesting how these things kind of can the family,
yes.
Including these worldviews that we have, the things we teach our children.
Yes.
And so I ended up in a hospice care situation, and in February of 1982, I succumbed to my disease. And I had a written will that, and I had a written will, and I suggest everyone get one, because at the time, I really did want to die. I believed I was going to die, and I believed the world was going to end up in a terrible condition. And the living will was specifically so that my family couldn't come in and no one could come in and hook me up to machines or tubes.
Oh, I
because
see.
Because I didn't want to be sustained that way. So that's why I had a living will. And my hospice caretaker, we had an agreement to wait about 6 hours after cessation of vital functions, which they had some pretty sophisticated, like amplified stethoscopes and things like that. And In the period leading up to that, we had actually visited the local mortuary and made all the contacts that we needed to. And as I said, I eventually succumbed to my disease. And I was monitored by my caretaker for an hour and a half with no vital signs. And I know that may sound unusual to people. But in the history of near-death study, in the history of resuscitation, that's not even close to having a record. So, but it should be way, if you don't have any vital signs, heartbeat or anything like that, you should have brain damage and physical damage.
Yes.
But the interesting thing about near-deathers is that, that they come back with no brain damage. And many of them have had no vital signs for over 50 minutes, which is way past, what they call cortex death.
Yes.
Death of the brain. And many of them, in fact, come back with no brain damage and, in fact, enhanced mental facilities. And this is fascinating. I belong to a group called IANS, which is International Association of Near-Death Studies, and they're a great international group. And can you imagine going to a conference of mostly people that have died and come back?
Wow, what a storytelling session you guys would have.
Huh? It is fascinating, and everyone's welcome to these conferences they have around the country. And there's a lot of local groups. You could look up IANS International and find out where your local group is. But I think my lesson is that I lived with a certain life attitude, and I really believed the world was going to end, and my world did end. And I literally... And how it happened for me is I literally felt like I woke up, but I was standing away from the bed looking at my body. It was just like being awake right now. I felt like I had woke up, but I looked over, and there was my body lying on the bed. And it was vivid. It wasn't a dream. And I was, panicked by this. I didn't know what to do.
So you felt panic emotion... On the other side, I mean, when you're out of your body, you felt kind of panicked.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Okay, can I ask you something I know is on people's minds?
Mm-hmm.
Right before you died, were you just feeling like you were in a sleeping state or coma? What kind of state?
No, I was withering away. I could only ingest milk at that time, so I was withering away pretty good. But no, I we believe this happened around sunrise, and I was asleep.
Okay.
I had had a dream that evening that I'd had a dream about my childhood. I was playing with my brother, and in this dream I saw a shower of sparks, like come from the sun, and that woke me up for a minute. And the last thing I remember is waking up and going, well, that was an interesting dream, then going back to sleep. And then the next thing I realize, I'm outside of my body looking at my body.
So you weren't gasping for breath or,
no.
like, having these horrible, oh, Lord, I can't breathe, none of that stuff.
No, thank goodness. But almost immediately, what you would call a life review began for me.
Okay.
And my life view began at the moment of my, quote, death and ticked backwards through all my life. And it was these were like going in a spiral around me, and they were like these movies of my life of so many things, of literally everything I'd ever done. And what astounded me was is all the things that I had forgotten or repressed were now being revealed to me. And my life ticked away. It was like counting down to zero. And for the first time in my life, I understood that I had repressed a lot of emotions and that I had walled myself in from the world with my belief system. And that had actually affected my whole life, and I had not really put the two together.
Mm-hmm.
And this has affected relationships I had. This has affected my entire... I had no view of the future. That's one thing I saw in my life review, that I had no picture of the future, which was interesting. I had no hopes. The other thing that happened was I got to understand the dynamics in my family. I saw things about my family that my mother had never told my brother and me. And after all this was over, I would have conversations with my mother for years afterwards, and I would tell her things that happened with the family. She said, "You weren't even born yet. I never told these stories." And I said, "Well, I witnessed much of this." As my life ticked down, what really stood out to me was all these little things that you do that you don't realize that are great things. There are things that you do just out of the pureness of your heart, like hugging someone with a broken heart, helping someone feel better, or like the time, and I saw in my life review, the time that I was on a busy, busy country road, and I saw a turtle trapped on the center line, and cars rushing back and forth, and I knew it was going to get killed. For some reason, I stopped the car, pulled over, jumped out of the car, and risked my life to save this turtle. And if you think about it, boy, that was really kind of dumb. You risked your life to save a turtle in the middle of the road. But that stood out to me in my life review as something really amazing. Stopping to help someone change a tire. These are the things that really stood out. I had won awards in art and things like that. None of that really stood out, but it was these human things, these things that really matter in the fabric of life that stood out to me. And as my life kept ticking away and ticking down to zero, I actually went from the last minute of my life all the way into my mother's womb in prenatal.
Wow.
I was aware of being conscious inside my mother's belly as she carried me. And I could tell her stories of things that were going on in vivid detail that she said, "You weren't even born yet. You weren't even here yet." I said, "But I was in your belly, and I could hear this, and I could feel your emotions. I could sense the arguments with my father." And it's this prenatal stuff that actually kind of set my attitude for the world I was coming in. And I think that's another lesson for people and children. As the memory I have of being a fetus in my mother's belly, I was actually fully conscious. And I was aware of emotions around me. And around me, my parents fought. My father, my biological father, was an alcoholic. And I had my mother left him when I was young, about the time I started school. And she was one of those mothers that never talked bad about her ex. So she never talked about this stuff, never. And I was telling her stories after I came back that shocked her, stories she'd never told anybody. And I could tell her about the fights that she had with him and what it did to me. The fights that she had with him, and because he was an alcoholic and quite abusive, gave me, the baby, the sense that this world I was coming into was a dangerous place.
Oh.
That these people loved each other, but they hurt each other. And literally, I could sense that this affects people in different ways, but for me, it made me angry.
Mm.
And I was born angry and stayed angry to the day I died. So you see how those things affect you even before you're born. You're affected about coming in and your world attitude about this world we're coming into.
Yes, I absolutely believe it. I actually do womb healings classes on that type of thing because I do believe it affects you a great deal, and it's nice to hear someone saying that.
Well, I was amazing to realize how conscious we are at every level. And then as I was a fetus in my mother's belly and all those memories came back and it ticked down to a tiny light, which I think was the first cell or egg of my mother being fertilized. And when that little light ticked, I found myself in total and complete darkness. And that was the loneliest feeling I've ever had. It was total and complete cut off from the world, and I didn't know what to do. It felt hellish to me, and I could hear voices, I could hear crying, I could hear laughter, and it felt like there were people around me in this darkness that were suffering in their own ways, or maybe it was people I knew that were suffering. It was quite confusing, but sort of hellish, and it was I just wanted to get out of that place, and I didn't know what to do. And yet the whole time, I kept noticing like this little starlight ahead of me, but it was so far away, and I couldn't get to it. And to my surprise, at about this time, an angel appeared to me. And I'm someone that, up until this time, never believed in angels at all. I thought they were figurines. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It totally surprised me that this angel appeared to me, and it was a golden angel, and it was quite large. And my first thought was, I said, are you the angel of death? And the angel said, I am Melon. And at that moment, I understood that this angel was my guardian angel, that metaphor
for my
higher self connection. There's many metaphors for this. You can call them guardian angels. You can call them different things, your guides or whatever. But here was my guardian angel, and the guardian angel was telling me, if you want to leave here, you have to go to the light. And I said, well, how do I get to the light? And the angel pointed to my heart, and in my heart was a little light.
Oh.
And so that's where, you know, the light in that tunnel, that begins in your heart in every human and is connected to that great light at the end of the tunnel, you might call it. So I had to recognize a light within myself and connect with the light. And as that happened, I moved towards the light. And it wasn't like a tunnel like you see, because, you know, before this ever happened, I'd never heard the word near death. I'd never heard this sort of stuff in my life before, being born in a small country town in the South. And I didn't know about any of this, but I moved towards the light and seemed like kind of a rainbow kind of light, and I moved towards the light with being guided. And then when I got to the light, everything stopped, and I'm standing with the light. And, of course, you know, like I guess all good non-believers, atheists, the first thing out of my mouth it seemed like was, are you God? Because I thought I was standing in the presence of God. And the light said to me, who and what is not God?
Ooh.
And instantly I understood that if you wanted to say who God really is, you'd have to name every single thing in the universe, and that would take forever. The answer I was given was the best answer for me, which was, it's all God. This is all God, everything, you, me. Everything in the universe is made of God stuff, literally. And one day we'll wake up and see that and treat each other that way. But then I had a long conversation with the light, and as far as researchers know, I'm the only one that actually stopped my experience and became very interactive with it. I didn't know this at the time until years and years later. I was sort of discovered by PMH Atwater.
Uh-huh.
The great writer on the subject, Phyllis Atwater. She has a great website, PMH Atwater. And then she introduced me to the great Dr. Ken Ring, who's written all the books.
Uh-huh.
And has studied over 10,000 near-death cases. And so I had an awful lot of time to spend with the light and ask every question I ever had on my mind. And I had a lot of questions. And all my questions in this were answered, And I, when I say all my questions were answered, I mean my questions. I believe each and every one of us has a different set of questions for the universe that makes us unique. But to my satisfaction, every question I could think of was answered, everything. And that included all the things I was ever interested in also. But one of the first questions I asked the light was, why was humanity even made or created? Humanity is this dark, evil thing. Humans are dangerous. And at that moment, the light turned into this mandala. Do you know what that is?
Yes, I do. And I
It's like a kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
In a way. It turned into this like kaleidoscope or mandala of what seemed like living human souls. And I was breathed. It felt like I was breathed into it.
Oh.
And in that space, I could look, it seemed like I could look into every human soul that had ever been, including my own. And to my amazement, and I know this sounds really strange to some people, but I was able to look and look and look, and I swear to you, I could see no evil in the core essence of any human that had ever been created, in your core essence, not your personality, not your programming, not your good or your bad life that you'd live, but your core essence, which is your direct connection to the source.
Yeah.
That there was no evil. There never could be. There's nothing you can do to make that dark. And in that moment, I fell in love with humanity, which up until that time I thought was a cancer on the planet.
Wow.
And that was quite transforming in my life to realize that, and I can get into some other workshops that I do, but I do a whole talk on how humans are the most graceful thing on the planet if you look at it from this different perspective. I got to look at humanity from the mother's perspective. You know, like Mother Nature, like your mother.
Yeah.
Would look at a child. And because a child makes a mess and squabbles and spills milk doesn't mean necessarily going to grow up to be a monster. But if you're a child fighting with another child over that milk or that cookie, it seems like hell, doesn't it?
Yes.
So that's the perspective I got to see, is that we are not wrong. We're not bad. We are young. Humans are like very young creations on this planet. And we act like children. You know, and we act like monkeys sometimes. I say that, you know, what I see in the world a lot right now is we're still in the monkey business times.
Okay.
You see a lot of monkey business out there. So I was able to ask questions about health and longevity, about why we live the lives that we live, and I was educated, which has become the fascination of my life now. I was educated in the what you might call the quantum science of aging and why we age and what we can do about it and longevity and the essence of living life itself. I've spent the rest of my life since my near-death experience working on this, researching this subject, which I still find the most fascinating subject in the world. At one point, when I had sort of run out of questions, the light said to me, "But what was your first question?" And suddenly I remembered that the first serious question of my life I could remember at that moment. And I was raised for a period until my mother remarried when I was 11 in Catholic boarding school. And I only came home on holidays. And let me tell you, being raised in a Catholic boarding school and being told you're going to go to hell and for eternity, you start contemplating very deep subjects at an early age.
Yeah.
And I remember wondering, and it became my fascination of why God would even bother to create humans or beings that would live such short, pathetic lives. I was thinking that when I was very young. So I realized that I had for so many years of my life had asked everyone I ever thought was a doctor, everyone I ever thought was a scientist or would be in the know. I used to ask everybody, why do we grow old and die? Why do we grow old and die? And nobody had an answer, of course. And I studied it right on through high school. And then I became an artist and kind of forgot about that whole thing. You know, at one point I wanted to be a doctor, but I gave that up and I became an artist and ended up as a stained glass artist, and had sort of forgot about my original question that was the burning question of my youth. Because I was this is why I wanted to become a doctor, was to understand why we grow old and die. And so the light reminded me, and I said, oh, yeah, why do we grow old and die, by the way?
Yeah.
And out of the light came two columns of light, one on my right and one on my left, like columns of light. And out of the right column stepped a little skinny man that looked like he was from India, and I heard the word Denshaw. And this man began to educate me on the healing properties of light and how the different colors of light could cure certain conditions and have certain health effects on the human body. And as it turned out, that turned out to be someone called Darius Denshaw, who was one of the earliest pioneers of healing with light and color.
Really?
And actually, I looked this up later, and his family still lives in New Jersey. But he was healing people with light and color back in the 1930s, but it was right when FDA got started, and he was one of the people that got persecuted. And so a lot of his books were burned, and I remind people that they used to have book burnings here in America right up until the 50s, public book burnings, and it was legal. It happened in New York City. It happened in many cities across the U.S. I don't know if you remember when, they even started burning Elvis records, remember, in the piles?
Yeah, because rock and roll was satanic.
People forget, you know, yeah. People used to burn books in the public square till fairly, fairly recently. So he educated me about light and color and how to heal. And then out of the left column, appeared a man who was short, portly, had a beret on and kind of a funny mustache, and he started educating me on starlight and the essence of the universe is electrons, which are made by stars. And he began teaching me this science that turned out to be what's called fractal geometry. He was teaching me quantum physics, and I was understanding it.
Wow.
And it turned out that this man, which Phyllis Atwater helped me discover who this man was, this man was Walter Russell.
Oh, really? I have every book he's written, I think.
It was Walter Russell of the University of Light in Charlottesville, Virginia. And when Phyllis showed me his picture, I said, that's the man who educated me. Isn't that funny? And he was one of the Renaissance men of America, if you study his life. Just
yes.
Way so far ahead of his time.
He really was. I heard that he had some writings that he was friends with Einstein, you know, and I heard that Einstein told him, you better seal these writings. I mean, not the stuff that's out there. He had some additional that Einstein advised him, you should seal these writings because humanity is not ready to hear this.
He was very, very advanced. You know, He was drawing fractal geometry by hand. You know, that's the most advanced kind of computer programs that we have today that only supercomputers can do.
Uh-huh.
He was drawing them by hand before computers were invented. That's how advanced he was.
Wow.
He also, by the way, because I've looked into his life since then, he also, being short and portly as he was, he's one of the guys that started figure skating in the world today. He started the first figure skating club. And it became an Olympic event eventually. So fascinating men. Well, these two men taught me and educated me. And then, and I was given formulas and frequencies and wavelengths down to what's called nanometers and all this stuff that I'd never had any education in because I barely got out of high school alive.
And do you remember it?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I asked to never forget it, and I never have, in the subsequent years after my experience, I wrote everything down, and eventually I met a very wealthy man by accident who was intrigued with what I was saying, and so he started funding think tanks for me. And he would bring in some very, very important scientists, You know, he'd fly them in, and we'd meet at some resort somewhere, and they'd all sit around talking to me. And we worked with people like Bruce Lipton. Are you familiar with him?
Yes.
Yeah, Bruce was in on the project early on. Professor Tiller, early on. It just went on and on. Bruce, I mean, Glenn Rhine, the top quantum biologist on the planet, and it was these people who understood what I was talking about finally. Because talking to my friends and family, they didn't know what they, you know, they were starting to call me ET.
Yes.
What planet was I from? And I was saying, we're going to heal with light, and here's how we're going to do it, and here's what we're going to build. And so, what was amazing is that I didn't realize that I was talking the field of quantum biology, which is the leading edge of biology today. Do you know what quantum biology is?
I do not.
Think of your atoms as biology. You're made of atoms. You're the core of your physical being is atomic. You're made of atoms, and then molecules, and then cells, and then organs. You know, that's the hierarchy of it.
Yes.
So you are first and foremost a nuclear structure, and this is what I was taught. We're nuclear beings. We're made of light. And what's interesting is. The field of quantum biology, which you can look about on the internet, is so fascinating because at the fundamental core of your being, your atomic structure, no two atoms actually touch each other. Did you know that? They can't.
I did know that.
And there's
because
more room.
You told me.
Yeah. There's more room between your atoms than there are atoms. And so no two atoms ever touch. And so how does your body actually stay alive? And this is what Walter Russell was trying to tell me, that the body stays alive because it lives on electrons, starlight. And, you know, electrons are made in stars, are starlight. So we are born of star stuff, we live on starlight, and we return to the light when we die. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And it's all about light. It's fascinating. And the more we researched this, the more they found out my wavelengths, frequencies, all were very accurate. And then when they started testing some of the devices that we built to experiment with, it was phenomenal. We could get people to heal 200 times faster. And this ended up in the advanced field that now is called phototherapy. But back then, you know, 25 years ago or so, when I was getting into this, no one understood what I was talking about. But now, you've heard of photofacials at the salon?
Yes.
This is what light can do, and so I've been very, very lucky to have been funded to do a lot of research for years on these subjects, and also become an expert in people that live to be 100. And that's one of my favorite subjects ever is longevity, who lives to be 100, and why. And how we can all, with just very simple changes in our lives, live a much longer life than you can imagine. And who is really living to be 100, and what is their story? That's what's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
So I don't want to leave people hanging, but so I had all this information. You can check it out on my website and people I've worked with and things. But there came a time in which I realized I would be coming back. I was being given a second chance. And so I was given a second chance, and the details are more on my website if you want to get into all the details.
Yes.
But I was given a chance to have another life, literally. And I actually came back into my body. The caretaker had been monitoring for an hour and a half, no vital signs, and of course the body was, you know, I don't know if you've ever been with someone when they've died, but
yes.
I have many times since then. And they're not passed out.
Oh no, the mouth falls open, the mouth will not close no matter what you do.
And the eyes change and
yes.
And so my caretaker who was experiencing this, you know, was convinced I was dead, and so she was literally going to call the mortuary early. She wasn't going to wait the 6 hours. And then she heard something in my room. And I guess what had happened was I had come back into my body, had tried to get out of bed and fallen on the floor. And she came into the room and she said, you were laying on the floor whispering. And she said, I put my ear to your lips and you were whispering, I love my life.
Oh,
I love my life.
I love that.
And I tell you, it really gets me every morning when I open my eyes and realize I'm alive. If you could just get that feeling, just to be alive. I will never complain again because I've only had an average dysfunctional life. There are people that have much worse lives and much better. But I can tell you this, whatever level you're at, there are people that would trade you the worst day of your life because even the worst day of your life is so filled with potential if you would just see it. And so being given a second chance, it took me literally about 7 years of talking to people where I finally ended up talking to the right people who then gave me a chance. And then that I've spent the rest of my time doing research on longevity and health and energy medicine. And that's my passion of my life to this day.
Well, that's just wonderful. And I've talked to you about doing a follow-up call and giving us some of your secrets to longevity.
I tell you, it's fascinating what's really going on there.
Yeah, just the information you have given me is things I've never heard of before, things that are astounding. And I love what you said. Everyone who attends that lecture is going to just feel so much better about themselves at the end because it's true. I just a little bit you've told me, I not only feel much better about myself, but about my family and the people around me. It's like I can see things through different eyes because of the information that you've shared with me on that.
It's become my passion, and you know, it's always seemed to me that it's kind of weird that we would have just the kind of lifespan where we'd live just long enough to get our head together, make a little money, and then we die. That's not right. We got to do something about that. And secondly, if you look at world history, the really great work begins when you're about 50. This is when most of the great work has happened in people's lives. So for especially for us baby boomers, life is just beginning at 50.
Yes. It's so,
so
true. Go ahead.
So we want to keep those years, the best years of your life. We want to give you as many quality years as we can in the peak of your life. When you know you've got life experience now, you've probably raised a family, you've got so much experience to go forward with, and that's when most people have done their best work in their life is 50 and over.
Yes, I feel like you spend the first 40 years just getting over yourself, just growing up. I feel like my 40s, I came alive, I started on this path I'm on now, and my 50s are just escalating to more and more, and I do want to live a nice, healthy, happy life, being happy. I don't want to live. I used to work in a nursing home when I was in my early 20s, and that's the most miserable job in the world, by the way. But to see those poor people that are, they're alive, but they're not alive. So being able to live to be a healthy, happy life is just awesome. So Melon, what I ask you would do, because I do want to share that Melon is a professional inventor, and he came on this call because I asked him, and it resonated with him. And Melon doesn't depend on doing calls or anything to make a living. He's got that covered. But he does have a passion to leave an institute of all this knowledge that he's learned, and I asked him if he would come on another telecall to share with us these anti-aging discoveries and some of this knowledge from the other side. And he said that he would, and I want everybody to write this date down. Next Sunday afternoon at this very same time, we're going to have Mr. Melon Thomas Benedict sharing with us the wonderful secrets that he learned from the other side, as well as the research that he's done studying people that actually have lived to be 100 and how we can do that healthily and happily. And at the end of this call, because I hope I can have a little bit of a question and answer, don't go anywhere. At the end of this call, I'm going to shoot you out an email and give you a chance to be one of the first to register for that call next week. It's only going to be $47, which is just awesome. And the first 50 are going to receive, when completed, Melon is almost completed, a book. It's a small book on anti-aging with all of this research written down. And the first 50 people that sign up will get a copy of that when it's completed, which should be within 2 weeks. But Melon, I want you to make sure you give out your website right now so that people can read more about you. Could you tell us your website?
Sure. It's www, and Melon, M-E-L-L-E-N, and then a hyphen, then Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S. So it's www.melon, M-E-L-L-E-N, hyphen, thomas.com.
Okay, hyphen. Okay.
Yeah, the hyphen's important for the Internet.
Yes, it is. And I'll also, I'm going to shoot out an email as soon as this is over to give them a chance to sign up for that call next Sunday, because the problem isn't the money. It's $47. The problem is going to be having space for all the people, because I know there's people want to know, how can I not only just live longer but be healthier and happy and able to be in my prime. Now that I have all this experience, how can I rock and roll up until I'm ready to go home? So, Melon, would you be open to answering a few questions if everybody that's listening will please do star six right now? No exceptions. Then I will take it off lecture mode, and what you're going to do now is, when you want to ask a question, you're going to say your name and the question clearly. And everybody's going to do star six, and then I'll ask just, you know, one person. So I'm taking it off lecture, and we'll see if people have complied. Hang on. Okay. All that noise you hear, hold on. Melon, that noise, I know you're not accustomed to doing teleclasses. It sounds like popcorn popping when people are doing star six. So that is people doing star six in order to give a chance. So I'm going to check it again and see if they've completed that.
Okay.
Okay. It doesn't sound like it. Okay, we're back to lecture mode. So because I know that people have questions, I'll ask a question while I'm waiting for people to complete their star sixing. When you came back into your body, was there any moment of impact, or did you just kind of wake up and there you were?
Literally, I don't remember anything until my caretaker was over me trying to help me move. And for several days after that, though, I was multidimensional. I didn't know if I was here or there.
Oh, okay.
And I remember my caretaker and I would have the strangest conversation, because when I would notice her, as she would walk by, I would say, am I alive? Am I alive? I didn't know. I was so multidimensional. And she would look at me with this look on her face, because this was really had a big impact on her, too. And she would say, you were dead. You were dead. I know you were dead. So we had this conversation that was sort of, you know, Twilight Zone. And it took several days for me to really feel like I was back in my body.
Wow. And when did you discover that your brain cancer was gone?
It was several months later, you know, after I left hospice and went home to live with my parents at that time, because I realized that I had a lot of work to do with them, which I did, and ended up on great terms with my parents before they died. But it was months later, and, you know, I didn't want to know, but I was talked into it. I didn't want to know. I didn't want to know if I had 6 months to live or anything. I didn't want to know, but I was talked into it. And I went back to the same doctor, and they did scans, and I remember him coming in to the office putting up the scans, and this time I didn't wisecrack, hey, doc, am I going to live? I'd learned my lesson.
Yeah.
I was very serious this time. And he put the scans up, and he said, well, this is very interesting. And I went, oh, what is it? And he said, well, there seems to be no trace of your cancer. And I said, I blurted out, it's a miracle. And he said, no, no, we call this spontaneous remissions.
Oh, yes, of course.
And but, you know, that's him saying that is what changed my my life and my focus. Because I said, what is a spontaneous remission? And he said, well, medical records, almost every known condition of humanity, from blindness to dental to MS to you name it, there have been documented spontaneous healings or remissions. And he said, you know, modern science doesn't really understand it, but we have tons of evidence that this happens. Sometimes upwards of about 15% of the cases will suddenly, the disease or the ailment will go away on its own. It wasn't anything the doctor did. And but then he said this, and this changed my focus. He said, look in this before scan, you see the cancer. Now, had we irradiated you or cut it out, you would always, every scan you had the rest of your life, you'd have a lesion or a cavity. He said, in a spontaneous remission, in many cases, what was cancer turned right back into normal tissue again, or somehow got taken away from the body, leaving no lesion.
Wow.
And when he said that, I said, what is the physics of that? What is the physics of a spontaneous remission? Here we have evidence in flesh that miracles happen. Call them whatever you want to call them.
Right.
But there must be physics to miracles, and that's what I've spent the rest of my life looking at, I believe God's magic is physics. It's the real magic.
Wow. So what did he have to say about that?
Who?
The doctor.
I never saw him again after that, except for many years later when I went to try to collect my records and everything. But I just said, what is the physics of that? And he said, we don't know. Nobody knows.
Oh,
and that's,
okay.
That's what triggered me to go try to find out, what is that? What makes a spontaneous remission happen?
Wow.
Because we have evidence all around us that it does happen.
Yes, we do. And did you slowly get back your health, or did you feel pretty good?
No, actually, I really started regenerating pretty quickly within a couple of weeks, and eating again, and gained weight. And then there came the point where, you know, I'm in a hospice situation where I came to die, but now it looks like I'm getting better. So they had a local doctor kind of give me a physical, and they said, well, you know, he looks healthy enough to go home. And so I left and decided at that point to go live at my parents' house for 2 years to work on what's called family karma.
Yes.
And that's probably the toughest thing I ever did. It makes the near-death experience look like a piece of cake.
Yes. We could have a teleclass about that, couldn't we?
Because they hadn't changed, I had. But by the end of that period, we had come to a peace and a resolution that many people wait to have that conversation at the grave, you know, the headstone of their parents or their brothers or sisters. I had all that before my parents died. We really did come to a very good place.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm going to check again and see if enough people have done Star 6 that we can take questions. Okay. Hello. This is Rebecca. It's not going to work. I'm sorry that we're not going to be able to have questions. It's just so many people were just eager to get on this line after 100 or so. It's just impossible to take questions. So what we will do is make this recording available, and you can share it with a friend if you'd like. And be looking for the email in about, 10 minutes, so that you can be one of the first 50 to sign up to get the fascinating information next weekend about who lives to be 100 and why. And we'll find out some more of this knowledge that Melon has from the other side. I'm just so thankful that you came on the call and shared with us. I feel like we just got a little tiny lick of the popsicle or taste of all the things that you have to share with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me on, and, you know, I just wish blessings to everybody, and, yeah, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. And Thomas, Mellon, I love my life, too.
Thank you.
Thank you. God bless.
Okay,
bye-bye, everyone.